From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The possibility of getting rid of Saddam is that of the Iraqi people. But the Iraqi people have asked the international community for assistance.
That was Ahmed Shalabi, former leader of the Iraqi National Congress, at a meeting of that group in London in December of 2002, 3 months before the U.S. invaded Iraq.
We believe that the international community participated in empowering Saddam Hussein so that he can suppress the Iraqi people. Now that the international community has seen the vile actions of Saddam and the crimes that he has committed against the Iraqi people, against Kuwait, against the Islamic Republic, and the terrorism that he has done, and the pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, which has brought disaster all over the Middle East and could precipitate biological or chemical or nuclear terrorism around the world. Now it is up to the international community to help the Iraqi people redress the balance and get rid of Saddam.
Shalabi died Tuesday in Baghdad at the age of 71. Ahmad Shalabi was perhaps the single Iraqi most associated with President George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq and topple its government in 2003. Shalabi reputedly took millions of dollars from the CIA, but as the outcome of the U.S. adventure began to sour, with the country descending into sectarian war that continues 13 years later, the Bush administration began to distance itself from him. The dangers of such sectarian violence were apparent back at that 2002 meeting of Shalabi's group. They were expressed by, among others, Ihsan Abdelwazir, a spokesperson for the Islamic movement, a group of Kurdish and Arab Sunnis based in northern Iraq, on camera.
I don't know why, but on purpose, they make the Sunni groups out of this conference, and we don't know why, and we believe that's very dangerous, and they bring a city-to-city fighting inside Iraq, and that's something very dangerous and nobody wished for.
Ahmed Shalabi dead at age 71. As the Saudi war against Yemen enters its ninth month, the country's fragile food security is deteriorating fast. That, according to Stéphane Dujarric, spokesperson for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
10 out of Yemen's 22 governorates are classified as facing food insecurity at emergency level, one step below famine. Yemen has one of the highest rates of child malnutrition in the world. Now an estimated 1 in 5 people is severely food insecure and in urgent need of food assistance. Also on Yemen, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says that a Category 3 cyclone is bearing down on Yemen's southern coast and is expected to make landfall early tomorrow morning. The impacts of the cyclone may be felt over large parts of the country, but are likely to be more severe in the coastal governorate of Shabwa and Hadamarut. Excuse for the pronunciation. These governorates have a combined population of about 1.8 million people, and about 1.4 million of whom are already considered in need of humanitarian support.
The Canadian company behind the controversial Keystone XL pipeline has requested that the U.S. Department of State suspend its 6-year-long review of the $8 billion project. Christine Delcuse, TransCanada's executive vice president, wrote in a letter to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry that, quote, TransCanada believes that it would be appropriate at this time for the State Department to pause in its review of the presidential permit application for Keystone XL, closed quote. The company said it believes that there is sound precedent for making the request. TransCanada noted that the U.S. had already suspended its review last year when the status of the pipeline was challenged, and it said believes, therefore, that another pause would be what it called appropriate. Although the effort to fast-track the project was approved by Congress earlier this year, it was vetoed by President Barack Obama. Jane Klebe, executive director of the pipeline opponent Bold Nebraska, made the following prediction after that veto was announced.
Even if they pulled some unicorn move in the House and Senate and got enough votes to override the veto, the reality is this pipeline will never be built. There's now this huge legal question in Nebraska about the pipeline route and about eminent domain rights. That will take anywhere from a year to 3 years. There's still an ongoing fight in South Dakota where the tribal nations are standing up for their treaty rights and their water rights in the South Dakota PUC. So this pipeline would never get built even if they got a permit today.
If the project is ultimately approved, the pipeline would deliver up to 830,000 barrels of oil a day from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to Nebraska. From there, it would connect with existing pipelines to carry more than 800,000 barrels of crude oil a day to refineries along the Texas Gulf Coast, stretching for a distance of 1,179 miles. Protesters stood outside the Michigan Department of Corrections headquarters in Lansing and made some noise Monday in solidarity with the imprisoned Reverend Edward Pinckney and, they said, all political prisoners. Speakers gave an update on the harassment they say Reverend Pinckney has been subjected to in recent weeks at Marquette Branch Prison. After the protest, supporters visited the offices of legislators at the state capitol and delivered information on Reverend Pinckney's case. Abiyomi Ezekwe is the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He was at the Lansing protest and spoke with us via Skype shortly thereafter.
There was an emergency demonstration called today by the Moratorium Now Coalition and other organizations from throughout the state of Michigan because of the treatment of Michigan's political prisoner, Reverend Edward Pinckney. He's a civil rights activist. He's the leader of the Black Autonomy Network community organization that's based in Benton Harbor. And he was framed up in 2014 on bogus charges of changing five dates on a recall petition. Now, in Michigan, ostensibly, the Constitution provides you the right to recall elected officials if you feel they're not fulfilling their duties or they're corrupt or whatever. And apparently, people in Benton Harbor felt that the mayor there, James Hightower, was more of a tool for the Whirlpool Corporation rather than serving the interests of the majority African-American population in Benton Harbor. At any rate, he was charged with five felony counts of forgery and five misdemeanor counts with no material evidence and no circumstantial evidence. He was railroaded through the courts during 2014, convicted by an all-white jury, and sentenced to 30 to 120 months in state prison. He was taken initially to Jackson, then transferred to another prison in northern Michigan. Then he was transferred at the request of his lawyer to an area closer to his family as well as his supporters in the southern part of the state. But Pinckney now was summarily transferred earlier in October to Marquette Prison, which is about 10 hours, perhaps 12 hours from where his family is and where most of his support is in the state of Michigan. Also, just a week and a half ago, his phone privileges were taken away by the Marquette prison officials. So we're saying that now he does not have access to his family, his supporters, nor can he phone them, nor can he call into meetings or talk shows because they claim that he was soliciting utilizing the telephone, and they wrote him four tickets. So this is just a mechanism to try to isolate him and to also further demoralize him and also to bring about a situation where his supporters are not in full contact with him on a regular basis, nor his family. So this demonstration that took place today on November the 2nd was designed for the specific purpose to tell the MDOC director, Heidi Washington, who's based in Lansing, that they should intervene and restore his phone privileges and also allow for him to be transferred to the southern part of Michigan, close to his family and supporters.
How long has he been in on this, since he was arrested? I mean, how long has he been incarcerated now?
Well, he was arrested April of 2014. They sent SWAT teams out to his house to arrest him over some recall petitions. Fortunately, he wasn't there, but he turned himself in. Then they placed him under house arrest on a tether where he could not leave his home or his garage for about 6 or 7 weeks. Then they eventually agreed to, you know, release him from house arrest where he could travel and talk about his case. But they did go ahead with the prosecution. They did impanel an all-white jury. And the case, we went and observed it. It was an atrocious violation and travesty of justice that took place in that courtroom. What was really put on trial was his political beliefs, the political beliefs of his colleagues, friends in Benton Harbor and Berrien County. For example, the judge allowed questions by the prosecution of witnesses, whether or not they were members of Banco, who chaired the Banco meetings, who attends the Banco meetings, what was said about Whirlpool Corporation at the Banco meetings, and so on and so forth. So it was clearly a highly politicized trial, and he was convicted by an all-white jury and then not even granted bond pending appeal of the conviction and sent off to prison. Now, he's issued and a motion for the granting of bond pending the outcome of the appeal to the state Supreme Court panel, three-person panel. It was denied, and then a reconsideration was also denied. Now he's appealing the decision of the state appeals court to the Michigan State Supreme Court, demanding that he be granted a bond pending appeal. He's already filed the appeal, but it may take a year or more for the appeals case to come before the state appeals panel.
So Banco being the Black Autonomy Network community organization that was founded by Reverend Pinckney.
Yes, in 2003, there was a rebellion in Benton Harbor. And as a result of that rebellion, the governor at that time, who was a Democrat, Jennifer Granholm, came in and supported a takeover of the lakefront area. There was a public park there, Jean-Clark Park, which was turned over to Harbor Shores Development Project. And they, of course, refurbished the park, the lakefront, and the homes on the lakefront, which was in total violation of the actual purpose of that park. It had been deeded to the city of Benton Harbor for the specific purpose of serving the people who live in Benton Harbor. Benton Harbor is now over a 90% African-American city. St. Joseph, where the seat of the county is, and where the court and the jail system is based, right across the lake, across the river, that area is predominantly white and much more affluent. And that's where he was tried. So it's a very, very segregated, very oppressed and exploited part of the state of Michigan. And they wanted to get Reverend Pinckney out of Berrien County, out of Benton Harbor, because he was challenging Whirlpool Corporation. He challenged the Harbor Shores project, which was part of it was turned into the Jack Nicklaus signature golf course. They've held two PGA senior and junior tournaments there since 2012. So he was opposing that, and they don't want any interference in these privatization and gentrification interests projects, which in fact do nothing except drive more African Americans and more poor people out of Berrien County.
This is something that's going on all over Michigan, you know, aside from in the United States, particularly in Michigan. It sounds like a small version of what's been happening with Detroit.
It is. Benton Harbor is, in a way, a microcosm of the city of Detroit. Flint, in many ways, is a microcosm of the city of Detroit. Same thing with Inkster and Highland Park. These majority African-American municipalities, which have been targeted for takeover, the abolition of basic bourgeois democratic rights, and, of course, privatization and super exploitation of both the land as well as the people who live there. They take public funds, public resources, and turn them over to private interests. So it's a pattern that's going on across the state of Michigan, and in fact, it's going on across the United States. You can see a systematic move across the U.S. to drive the oppressed peoples out of the major municipalities, and there's many ways in which they can do it, but a lot of it boils down to the denial of even basic bourgeois democratic rights. Like, they can't afford at this stage to allow people to recall their elected officials or to have people vote on referendums on whether or not tax dollars should be utilized to build golf courses, sports arenas, and other types of prestige projects, which do not create that many jobs, but it does create a lot of profits for people who are very wealthy.
And aside from doing away with even the pretension of bourgeois democracy, they're also doing away with even fundamental rights like the right to water.
Most definitely. And it was a situation in Detroit last year where it gained international attention. And they admitted, the spokesperson for the emergency manager said that the massive water shutoffs were part of the restructuring in Detroit, that people in Detroit had a culture of non-payment, and that had to be corrected. But what they really wanted to do was to balance their books on the backs of the poor and the working people in the city in order to make their bonds much more attractive as they enhanced a privatization effort with the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. So it was all very political. It was all driven by the fact that just 2 years before, they had turned over $537 million to pay off some bogus interest rate swaps involving the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. And four major financial institutions were involved in these interest rate swaps. So instead of taking that $537 million, or even a portion of it, to reinvest in ensuring that people had access to water, ensuring that people maintain their jobs, ensuring that the environmental quality of the water systems and the waterways in southeastern Michigan are maintained, they'd rather take that money and turn it over to some of the wealthiest institutions in this country and indeed throughout the world.
And that left tens of thousands, has left, because they still suffer that, tens of thousands of people in Detroit without water.
Yes, and they claimed after they were exposed, even during the bankruptcy process, because we were able to take this into the bankruptcy hearings, which they had never anticipated, that, you know, you had people that were able to make this a part of the whole bankruptcy proceedings. They appeared as if they were instituting some form of a moratorium on shutoffs, and they allowed people to set up payment plans in order to get their water back on and to maintain their services. But the payment plans were unsustainable. And people were, you know, could put down as little as $100, $150 to get their water back on. However, the payments for the water, which has escalated, and there are reasons why the water rates have escalated, because they have not maintained the system. And, of course, they have to pay off these bondholders.
Right, yeah.
But this was done. But the payment rates, there was something like less than 500 people who were able to meet the actual payment arrangements 9 months following the institution of this program. So during the summer, the water shutoffs resumed, and there were like 6,000 on average per month over the last over the recent period.
And even the United Nations chimed in on that.
Yes, there was, of course, the Council of Canadians, which is a human rights organization that has affiliations with the United Nations, wrote a statement saying this was a violation of human rights. The UN Rapporteur for Water Rights came to the city back in the fall of 2014, held hearings, did interviews with people, toured the city. They held a press conference. They issued a report saying that it was a violation of human rights. It was racism. And, of course, the imposed corporate mayor, Mike Dugan, rejected their findings, saying that they had a program in place to get people's water turned back on and to maintain service. And that program has failed because it's not based upon any realistic methodology for guaranteeing that water is a human right and everyone has a right to water. I mean, how can you deny people water and claim to be a democratic society?
And when you say the imposed mayor,
yes,
could you give us some details on that? And maybe you can make a connection with that and the recall election in Benton Harbor, because there's been this condition that's been imposed on all of the black majority cities in Michigan where the political control has been wrested away from the elected officials and placed in the hands of Lansing.
Yeah, the current mayor, Mike Dugan, he didn't even live in Detroit. He lived in Livonia, which is one of the most segregated cities in the United States. So when he put his name forward to run for mayor at the aegis of the corporate community in Detroit, he didn't even qualify He didn't meet the residency requirements that would qualify him to be on the ballot. And he was denied ballot access, so he ran as a write-in candidate. And I do not believe that tens of thousands of people in the city of Detroit wrote his name in and submitted it to the voting polls. So there were serious questions about his election, but it was never really investigated. So now there's an effort underway to get a new ordinance requiring the immediate reporting of election results, and that's being held up right now in the City of Detroit Law Department, which is being run by an appointee of Mike Duggan. And, of course, they want us to believe that tens of thousands of people, senior citizens and all types of people in a majority African-American city actually wrote his name in to be mayor. So he was put in place in Detroit to put a new face on the city and to further drive out the majority African-American population and by saying that the city is improving, that people like Dan Gilbert, who owns Quicken Loans and the Cleveland Cavaliers, that they're putting so much money in Detroit, and this is a good thing. But most of the money they're getting has been taken away from not only the people of Detroit, but the people of the state of Michigan. Mike Ilitch, who owns the Detroit Tigers, he's a pizza magnate, has reaped hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks from the people of the city of Detroit. They turned over the almost the entire lower region of Cass Corridor to him to build a new hockey arena. He owns the Detroit Red Wings as well. And just last week, as some type of supposed philanthropic activity, he donated $45 million to Wayne State University, the largest university in Detroit, and because they're going to name a business school after him. Now, he's a pizza magnate. He's a sports club owner. If that is the future of capitalism in the United States, then, of course, I don't believe it has much longevity because the whole character of the construction of sports arenas and the service industries does not bode well for working class people.
Wasn't it the tax abatements given to the last group of corporations that ran Detroit, particularly General Motors, that created the financial crisis that Detroit faces in the first place?
Yes, going back to the late 1970s, even under Coleman Young, who, in my opinion, was perhaps the best mayor that the city had, but he was the first African-American mayor. You know, he had constraints himself because there was, in effect, an embargo on the city, particularly after the rebellions in 1967, the other revolutionary activity that took place in the auto plants and in the communities and the schools. And then with the taking of power of Coleman Young, you know, with this background as being a communist and a labor organizer and, you know, a black militant, you know, there were a lot of forces that did not want private capital to invest in Detroit. In fact, there was a huge, large-scale disinvestment from the city. And the auto industry largely led that whole process by eliminating hundreds of thousands of jobs and also relocating their investments in other industries that were outside of the city of Detroit. So this has been going on now for well over 40 years. And of course, with further restructuring of the auto industry and the steel industry, more jobs were lost during the 1980s and 1990s. And also with the coming into the fore of predatory lending during the late 1990s, they pretty much finished off huge layers of the population in the city. For example, Detroit used to have the largest rate of home ownership among African Americans than any other city in the United States. But now it's been largely reversed. Because those people were targeted for these predatory loans, and they wound up losing their homes to foreclosure. And it was proven, even through congressional hearings, there's a massive senatorial report, over 600 pages, that was put together by a task force and panel by Carl Levin, who was a former Democratic senator in Michigan, that pointed out that there, you know, there was collusion that went on. And yet, none of those people were held accountable. None of the people who lost their homes were given money to buy new homes or put back into their homes. So in actuality, they allowed the banks and the real estate companies and the insurance companies to rob the people of Detroit. And it just didn't remain in Detroit. It spread all over the country, and it brought the United States capitalist system to the verge of collapse in 2008. And the federal government had to step in and bail them out. The Federal Reserve had to step in and bail them out with our money. And they're still being bailed out on a monthly and a yearly basis. So this purported recovery that's taking place right now in Detroit and other cities throughout the United States is not a stable recovery. It's a recovery based upon low-wage employment, and it's based upon inaccurate tabulation of unemployment, jobless figures. The labor participation rate is the lowest it's been in over 40 years in the United States, and that's why it appears as if the unemployment rate is going down. But wages are stagnating, they're going backwards, and there's no real recovery for working people in the United States.
And what you just described, the auto workers' jobs, the union auto workers' jobs were, after decades of struggle, were some of the best-paying manufacturing jobs that were made available to black folks in the United States. And many, many people in Detroit used that to build a home and build equity in it. And then when those jobs went away, the people were forced to use that equity to survive, to maintain their living, and they were subject to these predatory loans, and they essentially their equity got taken back.
Yes, I mean, people had borrowed money on their homes for years and years, and it was no big deal. You know, usually you could pay it back in 2 or 3 years. They set up lending schemes where you could never pay the loans off. And, of course, the loans were insured by the federal government in many cases, and also through insurance companies like AIG and their subsidiaries. And there was more of an incentive to foreclose on people rather than make arrangements for them, for people to pay off the loans or and stay in their homes, because the loans were insured at the mortgage value and not at the market value, because there was a precipitous decline in property values after 2007 and 2008. So those banks made out big time by cashing in on the insurance policies for the mortgage values of the homes, which were heavily overinflated. So this is clear collusion. Really, only a handful of people have actually been held accountable for this. Some of these settlements that have been announced by the federal government and by the banks themselves does not provide closure or repair for those people who were literally robbed of their homes. So a lot of the money winds back up in the banks. It winds up with some of the same interests who actually caused the crisis in the beginning.
And so circling back to the beginning, Reverend Pinckney, in an environment like this in a smaller town, Benton Harbor, attempts to organizes people to do something about it and finds himself in a jail cell.
Exactly. And that is speaks volumes, you know, about the current situation inside of the state of Michigan right now. We have the attacks on water rights, voting rights, increased police repression. For example, in Flint, they broke off the water system from the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, and they were running polluted water out of the tap into people's homes. You have people who have lead poisoning, copper poisoning. They could no longer hide it. It went on for approximately a year or more, and now the governor had to step in. Rick Snyder, who's a venture capitalist, had no previous experience in holding political office. Stepped in and had to reconnect the Flint water system back to the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. What's going to happen to those people, their children, who have lead and copper poisoning right now? You know, that is a type of damage that is irreversible. Are they going to have learning problems? They're going to have social problems. And how are those people going to be made whole? And, you know, there's going to be class action lawsuits inevitably. These right-wing conservatives who have been taking money away from the public and turning it over to private interests are going to run this state and indeed the entire country deeper and deeper into debt and financial ruin.
Hey, Abiyomi Ezekwe, thank you very much.
Appreciate all right, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.